Billy Budd by Herman Melville. In the time before steamships, a stroller along the docks of any considerable seaport would occasionally have his attention arrested by a group of bronzed mariners, man-of-war's men or merchant sailors in holiday attire, ashore on liberty. In certain instances they would flank or, like a bodyguard, quite surround some superior figure of their own class. That signal object was the handsome sailor, alike of the military and the merchant navies. The moral nature was seldom out of keeping with the physical make. Indeed, except as toned by the former, the comeliness and power, always attractive in masculine conjunction, hardly could have drawn the sort of honest homage the handsome sailor, in some examples, received from his less gifted associates. Such a cynosure, at least in aspect, and something such too in nature, though with important variations made apparent as the story proceeds, was a wilkin-eyed Billy Budd, or Baby Budd, as more familiarly under circumstances hereafter to be given, he at last came to be called. Aged 21, a foretopman of the British fleet toward the close of the last decade of the 18th century. It was not very long prior to the time of the narration that follows that he had entered the King's service, having been impressed on the narrow seas from a homeward-bound English merchantman called the Rights of Man into a 74-gun outward-bound HMS Indomitable, which ship, as was not unusual in those hurried days, having been obliged to put to sea short of her proper complement of men. Plump upon Billy at first sight in the gangway, the boarding officer, Lieutenant Ratcliffe, pounced, even before the merchantman's crew were formally mustered on the quarterdeck for his deliberate inspection, and him only he elected. To the surprise of the ship's company, though much to the lieutenant's satisfaction, Billy made no demur. But indeed, any demur would have been as idle as the protest of a goldfinch popped into a cage. Noting this uncomplaining acquiescence, all but cheerful, one might say, the shipmates turned a surprised glance of silent reproach at the sailor. The shipmaster was one of those worthy mortals found in every vocation, even the humbler ones, the sort of person whom everybody agrees in calling a respectable man. There was nothing this honest soul at heart loved better than simple peace and quiet. For the rest, he was 50 or thereabouts, a little inclined to corpulence, a prepossessing face, unwhiskered, and of an agreeable colour, a rather full face, humanely intelligent in expression. On a fair day, with a fair wind and all going well, a certain musical chime in his voice seemed to be the veritable unobstructed outcome of the innermost man. He had much prudence, much conscientiousness, and there were occasions when these virtues were the cause of overmuch disquietude in him. On a passage, so long as his craft was in any proximity to land, no sleep for Captain Graveling. He took to heart those serious responsibilities not so heavily borne by some shipmasters. Now, while Billy Budd was down in the forecastle getting his kit together, the Indomitable's lieutenant, burly and bluff, was in Captain Graveling's cabin, sitting before the shipmaster with a glass of rum and water in front of him. The master broke the silence, and there lurked a rueful reproach in the tone of his voice. "Lieutenant, you are going to take my best man from me, the jewel of 'em."
"Yes, I know," rejoined the other, immediately drawing back the tumbler, preliminary to a replenishing. "Yes, I know. Sorry. Beg pardon, but you don't understand, Lieutenant. See here now, before I shipped that young fellow, my forecastle was a rat pit of quarrels. It was black times, I tell you, aboard the Rights here. I was worried to that degree, my pipe had no comfort for me. But Billy came, and it was like a Catholic priest striking peace in an Irish shindy. Not that he preached to them, or did anything in particular. But a virtue went out of him, sugaring the sour ones. They took to him like hornets to treacle. All but the buffer of the gang, the big shaggy chap with the fire-red whiskers. He, indeed, out of envy, perhaps, of the newcomer, and thinking such a sweet and pleasant fellow as he mockingly designated him to the others, could hardly have the spirit of a gamecock. must needs bestir himself in trying to get up an ugly row with him? Billy forbore with him and reasoned with him in a pleasant way. He is something like myself, Lieutenant, to whom aught like a quarrel is hateful. But nothing served. So, in the second dog watch one day, the Red Whiskers, in presence of the others, under the pretense of showing Billy just whence a sirloin steak was cut, for the fellow had once been a butcher, insultingly gave him a dig under the ribs. Quick as lightning, Billy let fly his arm. I dare say he never meant to do quite as much as he did, but anyhow he gave the burly fellow a terrible drubbing. Well, it took about half a minute, I should think. And Lord bless you, the lubber was astonished at the celerity, and will you believe it, Lieutenant, the Red Whiskers now really loves Billy. But they all love him. Some of them do his washing, darn his old trousers for him. The carpenter is at odd times making a pretty little chest of drawers for him. Anybody will do anything for Billy Byrne. And it's the happy family here. But now, Lieutenant, if that young fella goes, I know how it'll be aboard the Rights. Not again, very soon, shall I lean over the capstan smoking a quiet pipe. No, not very soon again, I think. Aye, Lieutenant, you are going to take away the jewel of them. You are going to take away my peacemaker. Well, said the officer, who had been listening with amused interest to all this, and was now waxing merry with his tipple. Well, blessed are the peacemakers, especially the fighting peacemakers, and such are the 74 beauties, some of which you see poking their noses out of the portholes of yonder warship lying to for me, pointing through the cabin window at the Indomitable. But courage, don't look so downhearted, man. Why, I pledge you in advance the royal approbation. Rest assured that His Majesty will be delighted to know that in a time when his hardtack is not sought for by sailors with such avidity as it should be, a time also when some shipmasters privily resent the borrowing from them a tar or two for the service, His Majesty, I say, will be delighted to learn that one shipmaster at least cheerfully surrenders to the King the flower of his flock, a sailor who, with equal loyalty, makes no dissent. But where's my beauty? Ah! Here he comes, and by Jove, lugging along his chest, Apollo with his portmanteau. My man, stepping out to him, you can't take that big box aboard a warship. Put your duds in a bag, lad. Boot and saddle for the cavalry man, bag and hammock for the man of war's man. The transfer from chest to bag was made, and after seeing his man into the cutter, and then following him down, the lieutenant pushed off from the Rights of Man. But when the boat swept under the merchantman's stern, the officer and oarsman were noting, some bitterly and others with a grin, the name emblazoned there. Just then it was that the new recruit jumped up from the bow where the coxswain had directed him to sit, and waving his hat to his silent shipmates, sorrowfully looking over at him from the taffrail, bade the lads a genial good-bye. Then, making a salutation as to the ship herself, "And good-bye to you too, old Rights of Man."
"Down, sir!"
roared the lieutenant, instantly assuming all the rigour of his rank, though, with difficulty, suppressing a smile. To be sure, Billy's action was a terrible breach of naval decorum. But in that decorum he had never been instructed. In consideration of which, the lieutenant could hardly have been so energetic in reproof, but for the concluding farewell to the ship. This he rather took as meant to convey a covert sally on the new recruit's part, a sly slur at impressment in general, and that of himself in especial. And yet more likely, if satire it was in effect, it was hardly so by intention. For Billy, though happily endowed with the gaiety of high health, youth, and a free heart, was yet by no means of a satirical turn. The will to it and the sinister dexterity were alike wanting. To deal in double meanings and insinuation of any sort was quite foreign to his nature. As to his enforced enlistment, that he seemed to take pretty much as he was wont to take any vicissitude of weather. Like the animals, though no philosopher, he was, without knowing it, practically a fatalist. And it may be that he rather liked this adventurous turn in his affairs,
which promised an opening into novel scenes and martial excitements. Aboard to Indomitable, our merchant sailor was forthwith rated as an able seaman and assigned to the starboard watch of the foretop. He was soon at home in the service, not at all disliked for his unpretentious good looks and a sort of genial, happy-go-lucky air. No merrier man in his mess. In marked contrast to certain other individuals included, like himself, among the impressed portion of the ship's company. Though our new-made foretopman was well received in the top and on the gun decks, hardly here was he that cynosure he had previously been among those minor ship's companies of the merchant marine, with which companies only had he hitherto consorted. He was young, and despite his all but fully developed frame, in aspect looked even younger than he really was, owing to a lingering adolescent expression in the as yet smooth face, all but feminine in purity of natural complexion, but where, thanks to his seagoing, the lily was quite suppressed by the tan. To one essentially such a novice in the complexities of life, it was an abrupt transition from his former and simpler sphere to the more knowing world of a great warship. As the handsome sailor, Billy Budd's position aboard the 74 was something analogous to that of a rustic beauty transplanted from the provinces and brought into competition with the high-born dames of the court. But this change of circumstances he scarce noted. As little did he observe that something about him provoked an ambiguous smile in one or two harder faces among the blue jackets. Nor less unaware was he of the peculiar favourable effect his person and demeanour had upon the more intelligent gentlemen of the quarterdeck. Nor could this well have been otherwise. Cast in a mould peculiar to the finest physical examples of those Englishmen in whom the Saxon strain would seem not at all to partake of any Norman or other admixture, he showed, in fact, that humane look of reposeful good nature which the Greek sculptor in some instances gave to his heroic strongman Hercules. But this again was subtly modified by another and pervasive quality. The ear, small and shapely, the arch of the foot, the curve in mouth and nostril, but above all, something in the mobile expression, and every chance, attitude and movement, something suggestive of a mother eminently favoured by love and the graces. All this strangely indicated a lineage in direct contradiction to his lot. The mysteriousness here became less mysterious through a matter of fact elicited when Billy, at the capstan, was being formally mustered into the service. Asked by the officer, a small, brisk little gentleman, his place of birth, he replied, "Please, sir, I don't know."
"Don't know when you were born? Who was your father?"
"God knows, sir." Struck by the straightforward simplicity of these replies, the officer next asked,
"Do you know anything about your beginning?"
"No, sir. But I have heard that I was found in a pretty silk-lined basket hanging one morning from the knocker of a good man's door in Bristol."
"Found, say you? Well," throwing back his head and looking up and down the new recruit, "well, it turns out to have been a pretty good find. Hope they'll find some more like you, my man. The fleet sadly needs them."
Yes, Billy Budd was a foundling, and evidently no ignoble one. Noble descent was as evident in him as in a blood horse. For the rest, with little or no sharpness of faculty, or any trace of the wisdom of the serpent, nor yet quite a dove, he possessed that kind and degree of intelligence going along with the unconventional rectitude of a sound human creature. One to whom not yet has been proffered the questionable apple of knowledge. He was illiterate. He could not read, but he could sing, and, like the illiterate nightingale, was sometimes the composer of his own song.